Welcome back to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Glad you're joining us today. And really thrilled to be introducing you to someone I just met, but just in the few exchanges we've had over email, I like her a lot. I love the name of her blog. It's Wit's End. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know why that title might appeal to me. Sometimes I feel like I am definitely getting close to Wit's End with all the obfuscation and lies and distortions and childlike behavior on the part of some political leaders and some people who are in primetime network television, while those of us who are trying to get someone to pay attention to our environmental challenges and get America to wake up and tune into their environment are feeling sometimes like we're talking to ourselves. Well, maybe we are, but let's at least feel better in these conversations. Gail Zawocki, welcome to The Green Front.
Thank you, Betsy.
Wonderful to meet you, and tell me a little bit about your background. I know you study trees. We love trees, and we know that they do good things for us, and we love especially when they change color, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on right away, because you are watching the leaves change not quite as dramatically and gorgeously as they should be, given something that we took for granted as an annual event.
That's correct. I'm an old tree lover, too, and in fact, I've loved them my whole life, and I've planted hundreds of them. I live on a small farm in western New Jersey called Wit's End, and so I have watched them very closely because it's a big investment of time and effort to plant them all, and I wasn't too worried about them until the summer of 2008, and at that time, we'd been having a drought, and suddenly the trees, not just my little trees, but trees everywhere that I could see, just drooped. All their leaves wilted and hung straight down, and I found that very alarming. When your cut flowers do that, you know they're not coming back no matter how much water you give them. So I started looking into it, and for quite a while I was pretty convinced that the underlying reason that they were obviously suffering was drought from climate change, sort of a long-term, less snowpack, more irregular precipitation and so forth. And I thought that for about a year. And so I started learning everything I could about climate change because I hadn't really paid much attention to it, to tell you the truth. And I found plenty too alarming about the amplifying feedbacks and how quickly things are happening and how little people really are paying attention to it. So, but then what happened in the summer of 2009 was very interesting, and this is what I've had a very hard time getting people to pay attention to, is that the kind of damage to leaves that you can see this fall, particularly so 3 years later, gets worse every year, which is speckling, stippling, marginal leaf burn, they call it, when the edges around the leaves turn brown. And that you can look at any conifer right now, cedars, hemlocks, pine trees, and you can see the inner needles are turning yellow, and then they're going to fall off if they haven't already, leaving the interior kind of empty. All those things are actually symptoms of ozone, tropospheric ozone, which is another word for air pollution. And even though I was quite reluctant to think that air pollution is killing our trees, it's really the only explanation that fits the evidence. More evidence, for instance, you can see that plants that are growing in ponds, like lilies or lotus, have the same kind of damage to their leaves, and they're in water all the time. So it's not a lack of water. I mean, certainly drought and climate change and warmer temperatures are stressing the trees, but what's really making them look so awful this fall is ozone.
Mm. So the glaciers are melting, the storms are swirling, leveling cities, and now the trees are dying too. My, do you think we might get people's attention or what?
The reason I keep hammering away at this on my blog and constantly writing to foresters and scientists, most of whom think I'm a crank, is that ozone doesn't last as long in the atmosphere as CO2. So we've got climate change that's pretty much, I call it baked in the cake. Unfortunately, a lot of people today don't understand what that means because nobody bakes anymore, but it means you can't take the eggs and the flour and the butter and the sugar out of the cake once it's baked. It's really done. We've done that. And it's a huge problem. But we have an immediate, urgent problem, which is that we need our trees. We can't live without them. And also, the ozone, it's been known for 40 or 50 years, damages our annual agricultural crops. There was a program in the 80s called the National Crop Loss Assessment Network, and there were many, many experiments done at that point that proved that annual crops, depending on the level of ozone and the sensitivity of the crop and other issues like water availability, we can lose anywhere from 10% to 80% of the yield of our crops. So when you've got a world with a burgeoning overpopulation problem, we just can't afford to be losing crop yield, and crop quality as well goes down. You know, the seed production, the nutrient content goes down. And it's a global problem at this point because although ozone doesn't persist that long, there's so much of it and it's traveling so far that we have a background level that you have to remember plants evolved to live in ambient air that contained virtually no ozone. It's a completely human manufactured component in the atmosphere, and it's highly toxic.
Wow. You say you're not feeling 100% after being under the weather last week. I can imagine you at 100%. You are just full of knowledge and information. So,
well, I read about it all the time. I have three daughters, and I honestly don't want them to starve to death. I don't want them to be eaten by cannibals. And we're people are so oblivious. I call them the ignorers, you know. They'll make up all kinds of excuses why, like if they have a tree that's dying, they'll say, oh, it's insects, or it's disease, or it's fungus. And I'll say, no, those are all naturally occurring things. And the reason they're part of our ecosystem is to break down a dying tree and return those nutrients to the ecosystem. They don't kill healthy trees. So the trees are unhealthy to begin with. And they're not, and the other thing you'll hear is people say, oh, the trees are dying because they're old. They're not old, because they're meant to live, most of them, not all species, but a lot of them, like our maples and our oaks, they can live for 300 or 400 years, no problem. So when you see trees that are 50 years or 100 years that are dying, that's not normal.
I'm laughing because we are such kindred spirits. You reminded me, I used to have a name for those kind of people, and they're all out there in force right now, even where I live in supposedly progressive Northern California and the Bay Area, even Marin County. I call it the COD factor, C-O-D. That's my acronym for complacent, oblivious, and in denial. And I must say, after trying to get busy women to green tea parties to talk about 10 ways to green our routines, and everyone is suffering from terminal busyness, can't, Betsy, sorry, good luck, love what you're doing, but I'm too busy, and these are mostly mothers with kids who right. probably do everything they can for their children's future as far as healthcare, education, best, you know, college opportunities should open up, right. are completely, willfully not wanting to hear this stuff, and I'm at wit's end, which is one of the reasons I wanted right. to have you on the show. What is going on, Gail, just psychologically?
Well, I think, it's a big question, and I think that the denial is there because it's really soul-crushing. And then you go into sort of what I call distress syndrome. Instead of post-traumatic, it's pre-traumatic.
I like that too.
It's knowing that these looming catastrophes are coming at us. It's very hard to cope with. I mean, when I first came to understand it, to really recognize the unmistakable evidence that forests and trees are in decline, I went through, and still am going through, a constant grieving, because I'm a nature lover, and I wanted my children to have a beautiful future. My oldest daughter rides horses. She has a horse farm. My middle daughter's at UPenn finishing up as a vet, a horse vet. My middle daughter's studying sea otters at UC Santa Cruz. And they're all nature lovers. I brought them up out on the farm, and I wanted them to have a happy future. And I can see, quite frankly, that it's not going to be happy, and it's hard to get people to recognize that because it's very distressing. And the only way to fix it, if it can be fixed at this point, frankly, is very radical changes, really drastic curtailment of the kind of life that we're used to and expect and think that we deserve for the most part.
And the only thing more soul-crushing than, you know, what people are trying so hard to deny is those of us who, for some reason, didn't get that denial gene, and we are watching what's happening ecologically, politically, in mm-hmm. the media, and know what's coming, and nobody's listening. That is really soul challenging, I'll put it that
way.
Well,
it is, because people laugh at me, and I say, Cassandra was right. That's the Cassandra syndrome.
And when are they going to see us as being not wacky, but actually wise, or at least, you know, just let's get the conversation going. Let's talk about, you know, reality and climate realities and start talking about the solutions, and just to be putting so much energy into just trying to get people to have that conversation, to open up to, you know, what's going to come for sure if we don't wake up. That's the thing.
Well,
it's
already happening. I mean, there's climate disasters going on as we speak in Thailand and Paraguay, the floods, and then you've got the droughts and dust storms in Texas.
Russia, Pakistan, Joplin, Missouri. I mean, it's, you look at our own country now, you know. Quoting the international disasters up till a year ago, we can look no further than our own borders to see, you know, record-breaking hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, drought, fires. And you think that that might spark a conversation in the, you know, political debate in the national election coming up?
Yeah,
among
it's a very frightening topic, and I get accused often of being, you know, too depressing. Although I do try to keep a sense of humor. I like to do street theater kinds of protests when I get a chance,
but I agree.
In some circles,
gotta
I'm
laugh.
Called the diva of doom. And I am very doomy, but you can't fix a problem if you don't acknowledge that it's there. And
right.
There is a huge problem out there, which any of your listeners, I would encourage them to go outside and look at the leaves right now. There's something very wrong with them. They used to turn bright, beautiful colors in the fall, the deciduous leaves, but they were still supple and clear and smooth. And now you almost can't find a leaf that isn't speckled or who doesn't have that marginal leaf burn that I was talking about or isn't shriveled up. Of course, a lot of them have fallen already without ever turning color at all. They just either turn brown and fall off or just fall off. And that's not normal. And people forget. I was talking to one college girl at a demonstration in Washington about this, and I was describing these symptoms of, which are really well known, really well established in scientific literature, what it looks like when plants and trees have damage from ozone. And so I was telling her about this, and she looked at a tree that we happened to be standing next to. It could have been any tree in the city, but the one we were standing next to, and of course it had a bunch of bare branches. This is in the summer. It had some leaves sort of down on the lower part, but all the branches above were sticking up with no leaves. And she said, oh, you mean like that? And I said, exactly. And she said, oh, I thought trees were supposed to look like that. And I just laughed, and I said, no, they're not supposed to look like that. They're supposed to be robust and vibrant and really magnificent and beautiful. And finding that now is difficult. And I've been to California and even Costa Rica and seen, which is really frightening. And people write to me from all around the world, Europe, Canada, South America, and people are seeing the same kinds of things. Hawaii, there was just a YouTube that came out. Now, these are people that are convinced it's contrails, but the organic farmers of Hawaii are all saying that they have the exact same symptoms. And the contrail people are kind of interesting and funny because I think they're more comfortable thinking there's a government conspiracy that's causing the problems that they see to trees than admitting that it's our lifestyle that's the problem. We're all complicit in it.
That we might have seen the enemy and the enemy could be us. But if we recognize that, we could possibly turn it around in time. If we don't, if we put our heads back in the sand, go back to sleep, guaranteed to be hit harder in the head. And by the way, I subscribe to the grist.org credo, gloom and doom with a sense of humor. So as I'm laughing here with you, it beats crying. And that's what we have to do is use wit, use humor, use irony, whatever we can do to bring people into the conversation. I love what you have, the quote at the top of your blog, everybody sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences, of course, from Robert Louis Stevenson. And that's, it seems like what where we're headed, you know, it's like the party is over, we're waking up and smelling the CO2, but just a little bit too slowly. And we are, you know, up against, you know, just, there's a woman named Rebecca Costa who's written a fabulous book called Watchman's Rattle, and it's about why we are so slow to wake up to the crisis. It's because just evolution-wise, we have not had to change so quickly. We've never really faced something like this. Not to let humans and Americans off the hook, but there is some sociological, psychological component to it that those of us who are trying to raise awareness and get people more actively engaged, so it's not just we, you know, green people, and I still feel like we're kind of in our own world. I go to the same green conferences year after year, and it's pretty much the same people, both on stage speaking and the people in the audience. Sure, they've gotten a little more crowded, even selling out, but it's still the usual suspects, and that's quite discouraging. So what can we do to really, I think Occupy Wall Street is one of the things we're seeing that is really causing some hope. And you were down there, so share with us what you saw and heard, and if you heard much conversation about, you know, green topics.
Well, I was on board with Occupy Wall Street from the day that Adbusters call to Occupy landed in my email box. I was so excited because I think that linkage that they're making about corporate control of the government is really underlying so many other problems. Because if we had a real democracy, which I don't think we do anymore, if people were getting real information instead of propaganda from the corporate-owned media, I think there would be action about climate change. There would be action about pollution. People want that, but there's so many lies out there. There's so much money behind the lies, behind the think tanks.
And they're
so
dominating
people just
the airwaves.
They don't have the information.
Right.
I think that's a big problem. So Occupy Wall Street really excited me. I went on the very first day and the next day. Then I ended up, I had to go to California to see my daughter. So I was gone for a week, and I went back in a hurry when I heard that they were going to be evicted last Friday morning. So I went Thursday, determined to spend the night. So I sat up all night long. The rain was torrential, and I made a couple of really good friends. It was a great experience. And first thing in the morning, we were waiting for them to come in and evacuate everybody, and having an assembly where people were kind of being told to go here if you want to be arrested and here if you'd rather not, and how we're going to tactically handle this onslaught. And then we got the message that they had called it off, and it was one of the high points of my life. I was in tears. I was so, everybody felt so jubilant that we had, just with our bodies, you know, made a stand. And so then I went back on Saturday for the big march into Times Square, which was also marvelous. And if anybody looks on my blog, they'll see I had the chance to interview a young girl from Vermont who is just absolutely charming, really well-spoken, really sincere and sweet. And she was talking about things that are my big concerns, which is that the mainstream environmental organizations haven't been effective.
Right.
Not necessarily always their fault, but there are issues that they don't tackle with. They don't tackle the systemic change that needs to happen in our government in order to have the regulation and in order to have the legislation to do something, you know, substantive about climate change. And this young girl was so articulate in the way she described her disillusionment with those organizations that are, many of them are corporate funded. She came to Occupy Wall Street because she thought, here are some people who are really willing to put their butts on the line and stay put until things change.
And, you know, my experience with the large environmental organizations is, you know, they're mostly, they're talking to the